This episode is sponsored by Fright Rags. Right now, they have a brand new Creepshow collection, including shirts and hoodies. And they also have an all-new Jigsaw collection in honor of the Saw sequel.
And check out the officially licensed trick-or-treat and Halloween lines on shirts, pins, and more.
Yeah, and they have the General Mills line still, including the awesome t-shirts and, you know, these monster cereals, which, again, I don't think, Elric, you're familiar with monster cereals?
How do you
we didn't have them
cereals?
There, but I did know them.
You knew
the pump icon.
Yeah. Well, look, you know the deal with Fright Rags. All the artwork is custom. It's made by top horror artist talents. And right now, you can get 10% off your next order. Just enter Shockwaves 1217 at checkout.
And Ryan's actually wearing a Creepshow shirt right now, which is super cool.
This episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder, brought to you by AMC Networks. Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thrillers, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals, and there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore.
New this week on Shudder is Another Evil. After encountering a ghost in their vacation home, Dan and his wife Mary consult an exorcist. Unsatisfied with the verdict, Dan goes behind his wife's back to seek a second opinion and secretly hires Oss, who promises to get rid of the beings. Oss and Dan spend a week together in the vacation home, excising the evil beings, but Dan soon realizes that ridding the home of evil simply won't be as simple as it seems.
Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership, but our listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. Just enter promo code SHOCK, S-H-O-C-K, at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere. And I'll say, I got the new Apple TV, I subscribed to Shudder, brought my account on there, and now my dogs watch Shudder 24/7. Because I put it on in the background for them to just chill out and
not
watch
just
horror
for
movies.
Hearts,
it doesn't screw them up. They're not
hits.
Like, oh my God, the music's like weirding me out.
No, dog approved. They love watching Among the Living. They watched Pieces last night when I came home. I caught them watching Pieces. They love it.
They love it.
I love it.
I bet your dog said to you, it's exactly what you think it is.
Bastards.
Bastard.
Bark. Hello and welcome to episode 73 of Shockwaves. Wow, we're up to 73. It's pretty insane.
Yeah. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. Sitting with me is Elric Kane.
Hey, man.
Hey, man. How's How you feeling, buddy?
I feel you're like, right? I'm developing telekinesis or something. My head is expanding. I'm doing my scanners today. I don't know what's going on.
All right, you're going to make it.
I'll make it.
Let's get talking.
We've only got two episodes.
Good.
I'm good. Big day.
Also with us, Rebecca McKendry.
Hello, gents. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. And also Ryan Turk.
I'm feeling super.
You're feeling super, huh? Right on.
Feeling great.
Not as happy as your dogs who watch Shudder now, apparently.
They do watch Shudder.
Look at that. There is so much to talk about. I'm just going to dive right in, okay? Because I watched two by Dario Argento, one
awesome.
Great and one not so great. So we'll have to.
Oh, really? You both watched two Dario?
I watched one Dario. Okay.
So let's start with the great. I had never seen this. His first film, Four Flies on Grey Velvet.
You and a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. It's
well, that's not his first one.
Is it not?
No.
Technically?
I thought that
one comes after.
I thought this was before.
I'm Googling
Bird
this
with the Crystal Plumage is definitely first. I think, I don't know what the distrib problem was, but that was very hard to find for a very long time.
Yeah, it was. It's. I mean, it says it right on the box cover that it is his lost gem. But Shameless, which I believe is a UK company, put it out on Blu-ray and restored the whole thing.
Oh, cool.
And it is an all-region release. I actually bought it off U.S. Amazon.
Oh, cool.
It's a little pricey, but I mean, it's a lost Argento movie, so it's kind of worth it. This movie is freaking excellent. I was actually kind of blown away, and it's actually now up there as one of my favorite Argento movies. I like it more than Bird with the Crystal Plumage.
Wow.
It's basically
classic early Argento. It starts with a band rocking out, an Italian rock band.
A drummer, right?
It's a drummer. The main character is a drummer. And there's like, I mean, he is like directing wise, like he's just like fucking on game because there's like this amazing shot of the band, right? In like a circle. And then like it comes into focus and you're inside the guitar. Mm-hmm. Then you see the strings. There's like, man, like Dario's like directing the shit out of this thing.
This is the one where the band members, like one of them keeps finding things around the house and he's like, who the fuck left this here? Am I confusing this?
Sort of, not really. Okay. What happens is, all right, so he's in a band rehearsal and he kind of like sort of doesn't get along with one of the guys in the band. He's got a wife and he's got this guy that's following him, this really creepy guy in like a trench coat. And so in the kind of in the opening of the movie, he decides to follow him back and be like, what are you doing? And then it's just like one of the most bizarre like Argento scenes where he follows him into like an abandoned, like, I don't know, like a stage, like a place that like does plays or whatever. Yeah. And then he gets like an altercation with the guy. The guy pulls out a knife and the drummer ends up grabbing the knife and accidentally stabbing the guy that's following him. Mm-hmm. But while all this is happening, there's like some really creepy fucking weird dude with a mask on that's taking photos of the whole thing. Like just perfectly synchronized where it's like, yep, caught you murdering somebody. Yeah.
And he's the same guy from Valentine.
He's wearing kind of a similar mask. Yeah.
I love that.
It's a great mask. And then so from there, it just becomes this whole thing where it's like, who, like he's keeping this quote unquote murder a secret. And he's getting kind of like harassed by, you know, who could this person be? And then some more murders start happening with people kind of in his peripheral. And, but one, you know, one of the greatest characters, I think, in all of Argento's movies is the private detective, private investigator that he hires, who, you know, this is what, early 70s? Super flamboyant gay man is the one that is hired. And he even says, he's like, I have zero track record. I'm not good at this at all. He's like, but I have a feeling that this is going to be the case that I crack.
Nice.
And there's a great payoff to that kind of joke. But yeah, I mean, this is just accept. And yet again, kind of one of those weird Argento twists that you just don't see coming at all, where you're like, oh, alrighty then.
Yeah.
but I thought it was excellent. The music's great, the kills are great, and it's Argento directing and firing on all cylinders. So,
and it was always hard to find. I saw a bootleg of it like 10 years ago and I remember liking it a lot, but thinking it wasn't like major Argento, but again, it was a shitty copy. So
no, this one's pretty great. There's a regular restoration on there, and then there's one with I guess it's like extended, but it's like a few scenes here and there are standard def. Like it was the only elements they could find. Mm. But even that is literally just a few seconds here and there.
I haven't seen that in ages. I gotta get it.
Yeah, it's a great disc and I definitely recommend it, especially if you're on an Argento kick.
Nice.
So what Argento did you see? Because then we'll circle back and I'll tell
you. I watched Bird with the Crystal Plumage.
Oh, okay. You got the Arrow. You
guys are doing the early stuff.
Yeah,
I love that film. I think it's really well made.
Here's the funny thing. Whenever I go into a Dario Argento movie, it's like a whole brand new experience because for some reason my brain comprehends the aesthetic and the beauty and all of that stuff, but I always forget the stories. Mm-hmm. I legitimately forget who the killer might be.
I forget the incident.
I think that's a giallo thing. I think giallos are
really
just like I just never
there
remember.
There are some giallos where really? I'm like, oh yeah, I know who the killer is. I remember that. I remember
yeah,
this.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe it is Dario.
Yeah, but,
for me,
but for his movies, it's always a new experience going in. So Bird with the Crystal Plumage, which I've seen quite a few times, I sat down. I was like, oh, okay, this is the one about the journalist who witnesses a murder in an art gallery. And then I was like, oh, right. And then the girl that was getting it wasn't even a murder. She was it was an attempted murder. He stopped it and the killer ran off. And it was about him piecing the clues together as to who the murderer
what
was.
What he really saw.
But it is a fantastic film. Every time I watch this movie, it transports me to another time. I feel completely immersed in it. The colors, it's not as vibrant as Suspiria or something like Deep Red, but it's just got a certain atmosphere to it that's very natural, much like Tenebrae, I feel.
Well, the stuff with the painting in this movie is so great. Like, narratively great. Also, aesthetically, like this painting that actually is a clue to the whole movie and it's really kind of disturbing.
Yeah,
of the painting is kind of amazing. but
also,
it's just really, a smart film.
Yeah, the painting, the characters, a lot of great characters in it. The guy the painter the cat guy who's just eating like
that's what happened to your dog from watching Shudder. What happens to his cat?
But it's a It's just a very well done movie for his, I believe it's his first script.
I looked it up. Bird is his first movie.
His first
his second one,
screenplay.
His Cat of Nine Tails, and then Four Flies.
Yeah, right. He'd worked
he's
on screenplays.
He's a co-writer Once Upon a Time in the West. For Leon.
Right, right. But I mean, in terms of like first giallo, first his own thing.
I'll tell you that this is this, and I probably said this not long ago, but when I went to that Argento All Nighter, the biggest revelation I had watching his work in a row was that those first few films, he's a writer. And at a certain point, he makes a conscious decision to not be a writer and to just be like an aesthetics director, which is actually what made him famous. And there's a period where that's just the best stuff ever. But what's interesting about those first four or five movies, his dialogue's funny.
Yeah.
The plots are smart. Yeah. So clearly he actually had a writer's mind and just got rid of it. He literally said, no. Once he went to Suspiria, he went all the way down this other path.
Well, and what was interesting too is that he was talking about in the bonus feature is how the producers were like, they were getting dailies back and you're like, hey, this isn't what we're seeing, isn't really resonating as a thriller. This is something else. And he's like, no, just trust me, trust me, trust me. And then they finally got the movie back and they're like, okay, great. But what's interesting too, I remember reading that Tony Musante, who's the lead, was a pain in the ass. So it was just funny watching, knowing that and how apparently they clashed a lot and then just seeing it come through. He's great. He's great You know, he's really good. But really, just an awesome, solid giallo.
Yeah.
You know, boiling down to the black-garbed, black-gloved killer to the whispering on the telephone.
Yeah.
And then the trail of breadcrumbs that he goes on. It bottoms out for, I'd say about 15 to 20 minutes where you kind of feel checked out because the lead is just spinning his wheels and it's not going anywhere. But once he gets to the painter, that's when it kind of starts firing off cylinders and starts racing towards the finish.
And those giallos are always about sexuality, which I like, because like slasher films are really just, we use sex just that they had sex and then they died.
Yeah.
But these are always about a character who's like fucked up sexually or has a weird desire. And I love that about giallos. Yeah. They're always a little off, like, I guess that's the weird Catholic Italian upbringing. Like, you know, it has to come out somehow.
But it set me off on a November December viewing spree where I'm just going to watch giallos. I want to make sure I pepper those in because Shudder had one on the other day and I almost got like caught up in it. I was like, no, I want us to watch this from the beginning again.
So, yeah, I just pre-ordered Cat of Nine Tails because Arrow announced it and available through Diabolik DVD.
Hmm.
They've been doing a great job at these Argento titles, it's like screw it, I got to get it.
Yeah,
Elric, hit us.
I mean, I saw a bunch of stuff. I finally got a couple art house ones. I'll just start with those ones. I finally saw
the art house. Get
I know.
Out of here.
Yeah, I finally saw The Lure, which I wasn't as excited to see because of it being a musical. Sorry, Becca.
That's lame.
But once I saw it, it's really fun.
It's weird.
Yeah, it's fun, but it's like pop fun.
Uh-huh.
It's a Criterion release, and I would say it's probably more Criterion than it is horror, but it's definitely a mix. I mean, these things, when they, and for those who don't realize, this is about the two beautiful teen mermaids who wash up on shore. They're taken in by this cheesy band who plays nightclubs.
It's like a disco scene.
It's like a disco scene in Poland. And then they basically kind of get into sexual relations with other people. But at a certain point, you do see them as almost like vampires. Like they're vampiric. They have sharp teeth. And there's something really, there's aesthetically, it's a deeply pleasing movie. Like it's nice to watch. The songs are cool and fun. I had a lot of fun watching it. It's kind of my kind of movie. And then other parts it didn't like, I don't know if it will stay with me, be like a top 10 type movie, but I thought it was really cool. And I could totally watching it. I'm like, man, some kid's going to watch this. And it's going to be like their favorite movie of all time. Like it has cult written all over it.
Completely.
Which is cool.
The songs are catchy.
The songs are catchy. Yeah.
And I watched it right around the same time I saw Neon Demon. Mm-hmm. Like I remember seeing them both within the same couple of days, and both of them are like, these are so beautiful. And
this
I don't
one's
know
more
what's
charming.
Yeah.
This has a lot of charm because the songs are, it's the pop value I think is super fun. It'd probably be a good soundtrack.
Time, it's got a Moulin Rouge quality.
Yeah, it does. Actually.
But they keep that talking about having sex with their fishtails.
Oh, yeah. No, and it's super bizarre. Some of the fish stuff, it's
weird.
Yeah, no, but it would double with Splash nicely. You watch Splash, you get all randy, and then you top it off with the good stuff. But I liked it, and I think people should check it out. I think that is streaming on like Amazon Prime. And then I watched A Ghost Story, which I won't spend too much time on because it's definitely an art house film. It's not a horror film, but it uses a horror convention, which is the classic ghost. Mm-hmm. And it's actually it's a nice little movie. A lot of people said they thought it would be my kind of thing, and it kind of is. It's one of those movies that not a lot happens. So for those who don't know, it's very Terrence Malick-y, but it's Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. And in the first few minutes, so I'm not spoiling anything, Casey Affleck passes away and basically is a ghost under a sheet, like a classic spook ghost, cartoon ghost. And he is forced to, you never see that actor really again that. And he's just watches as things go by without him. And it's got this very sad, very simple, minimal quality to it. It's one of those movies you're not feeling much as you're watching it. And then the second it ends, you kind of feel quite a lot, and you suddenly feel like you start thinking about yourself, and it's quite existential. But it's an interesting use of these kind of movies that take a horror icon or a horror thing, but really is not a horror. There's no one in my mind who could really ever say this is a horror film.
But just David Lowery,
iconography. He's a great editor, great director.
He's a great director, I feel.
He is strong.
And he effectively gets you to jump twice. There are two great jump scares in the movie.
That's true, yeah.
But the rest of it, I've seen it twice now. I saw it at Sundance. I saw it. I took my fiance to go see it, and she was like bawling through most of it.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really interesting
movie. It makes you feel a lot. Yeah.
There's a part, it's not really spoiling because not a lot happens, but there's a part where he's like, you know, he's in his house as a ghost and there's nothing else there and people have moved on and life keeps going. And he looks out his window and across the house, there's another house across the way and somebody wearing the exact same thing looks over him and they just look at each other and then they start telepathically communicating. Yeah. And the dialogue's kind of cheesy and funny. And you're like, this is really weird tonal shift, but it works. And you keep going. And it's a shortish movie. I would recommend it to people who like kind of saying offbeat and... Mm-hmm. But it definitely had some emotional weight. So those are the two little art housey types for this week.
Excellent. Becca.
Nice. I'll start with the weird one. So are you guys familiar with Garage House Pictures?
You guys. Yeah. He's going to do art house. She's going to do a weird one.
Actually, somebody tweeted at me this week and was like, I love when Becca leads with, here's a weird one, because I guarantee it's something you've never seen before. Which it isn't.
Both of you are on Garage House Films.
So they are Exhumed Films distribution wing. Exhumed Films in Philadelphia do all the great screenings. Mm-hmm. This is their distro company.
So Garage House, they've been doing a couple of really good releases this year where they've been kind of releasing this stuff that's never before been available. They're not like, you know, taking it and redoing it and releasing this film that you saw in the 80s. This stuff has never been available before. Cool. And so I talked about one of their films earlier in the year, The Dismembered. And so this weekend I watched The Satanist, which is from 1968. And this was a never seen before softcore horror film. And there weren't a lot of those that were going on at this time. There was a lot of softcore stuff happening, and obviously there was some horror stuff, but not a lot of crossover, except for this one guy who made like seven of them. His name was Zoltan Spencer. And the premise of it
is,
if your name is Zoltan, you have to make Satan.
I know. It's a really great name. It's a really great name, guys. I wish that Zoltan Spencer was still with us. This was actually his first film. He went on to make a whole bunch more horror softcore crossovers. I can best describe it as very hairy because it was the end of the 60s. And so every single time the lead protagonist keeps getting naked through the whole thing. And he is just one, like, it's literally like a sweater with some nipples poking through. But he keeps getting naked.
That has its fan base out there, trust me.
Yeah. So it's a really cool soundtrack, actually. That was part of my favorite things. The whole concept of it is that this writer, he's been in a car accident and he had a nervous breakdown. And so his wife decides to take him on a retreat in the country. So they get a country house, which is clearly Melrose or Mulholland Drive. Like, they're clearly in the hills, but fine. It's a country house. And they go, but then he gets there and they find this neighbor woman to be a little off-putting. And then the more that they kind of investigate her, they realize that she's a Satanist and she's having all these satanic orgies. And she's invited him to a party on Friday night and they really don't want to go, but it would be unneighborly not to. But they suspect it might be a black mass, but how are you going to get out of it? So they go and whoops, it's a black mass. And
these are social problems.
These are big social problems.
I worry about
guys.
This every weekend.
And then, but through the whole thing, like he borrows her book and he's doing it for research. And then he goes over and is watching her have crazy lesbian sex, like satanic lesbian sex, if there is such a thing.
Boy.
The window.
Safe satanic lesbian sex? Or
safe, yeah.
Satanic lesbian sex.
Satanic lesbian
but
sex.
But it's not safe.
It's the 1960s, so they weren't allowed to show anything below the belt. So it feels very – they literally oil each other's boobs for about 20 minutes.
Got it.
And So that's the movie. But that said, by the way, all of these sex scenes are he's always peeping through the windows and seeing them from afar. And it's always in this very clinical manner of, I'm watching for research. So he's literally like looking through the windows going, well, I'm a writer, so this is okay. which is great. But briefly, in the midst of all of this very unfulfilling softcore, is some very interesting shots. There's a couple of really cool shots
some
in there.
Some good dolly moves.
A couple good dolly moves.
Steadicam.
Y'all got to watch this movie because there's a sweet dolly shot in it.
Somewhere in there. So the history of the film is actually pretty interesting as well. It was when it was originally made in 1968, it was released at the Pussyfoot Clubs around Los Angeles, which were kind of popular strip clubs at the time. Oh. And it was slated for a nationwide release in 1971. But between 1968, when he made the film, and the 1971 nationwide release, the majority of movie palaces and theaters that would take this type of film decided that they would no longer run black and white movies. So it's a black and white film. And so it literally saw no distribution. Only 5 prints were made. 1 remains. They actually did a screening of it at the Alamo Draft Houses recently. And all I could think is how weird it would be. Like, I fast forwarded through like the 20-minute oiling sequence. And so the other really long, because I mean, it's the 1960s and you weren't allowed to show much. So it's just a lot of like dry humping and a lot of making out. And so, you know, you fast forward through those, but I couldn't imagine watching them in a theater. But
I missed dry
they
humping.
Did. Just dry humping.
You become an adult, you move forward, and then you never go backwards a
you
step.
Should tell. Right.
This is the problem with sexuality. You never get to go do it backwards.
You know, we never dry hump anymore. Why don't we dry hump anymore?
It was so innocent.
Let's just get romantic.
Let's just dry hump for a couple hours and do nothing.
Let's just make out dry hump.
Yeah. Then I'll just go home.
I want to be like Sydney at the start of Scream. Just on, above the clothes.
I just want to feel that chafing again.
Yeah.
So this is The Satanist currently on Blu-ray from Garage House Pictures.
I think we sold it.
Yeah, so if you see a spike in sales, you
that's us.
Okay, so this is the tough one. As I will not bore you with the details, but obviously my 3D TV, which I love much, died on me. But I was able to find a new one, and it took a lot of effort. It's in 2016 because they don't make 3D TVs anymore. But I am an idiot that owns 150 3D Blu-rays, and I'm like, I need to be able to watch these.
I love that you know the specific number.
Oh, yes, yes.
You don't just say, I have a lot, or
it's
a bookshelf
roughly,
full.
It's roughly 150, somewhere in that range. But anyway, the point being is my movie club, my Bad Movie Brigade, I emailed them all, and I'm like, here's a list of every 3D title I own. This TV will hopefully last at least 4 years, more than, you know. I've got a tube TV that Joe Lynch gave me that's 20 years old.
Oh, yeah.
That thing is still going strong. But a goddamn Sony 3D TV lasts 4 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was like, look, we got 4 years to make it through these. What do you guys want to watch? Steve Scarlatta, good friend of the show, he's been on before. He immediately replied saying, I want to watch Dario Argento's Dracula 3D and I, Frankenstein, because I've never seen either.
Why?
And I was like, wow, okay. And
I got to do that one. I got to do Dracula.
Yes.
You
and
may
then,
want to talk to him, Rob. I'm a little worried about him.
This is not surprising coming from
Steve. Yeah.
So then I was like, you know what? I'm going to triple down because I had just got an import of, yes, a movie I hate, but I got the UK version of The Mummy, the Tom Cruise one, in 3D because I was like, well, I want to watch it in 3D. And I was like, let's do a triple feature of the worst possible Universal reinterpretations, Argento's Dracula 3D, I, Frankenstein, and The Mummy.
That's good thematics. Good job.
Josh Miller was the first person to reply saying, brutal, I'm in. And so we were off and running. Let me tell you, it was quite something. It was fun. It was fun to see it with like-minded individuals, and we got to have a lot of in-depth conversation. Argento's Dracula is, you know, it's a real bummer because it's actually like kind of a missed opportunity. There's just something went wrong.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is in 3D, it is spectacularly crafted in terms of like, there's so much beautiful depth. Like a lot of it takes place in the woods and stuff like that. A lot of it's in the daytime, which is kind of, at least in my memory, kind of a complete opposite of what Argento normally does. Like, but a lot of it's like brightly lit in the day. He found a girl, Ozzy is in it, his daughter, but he found a girl that looks exactly like Ozzy, but younger, to be Mina. And so I'd say like the first, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes is actually pretty decent. You're like, oh, all right, this is pretty interesting. And then there's even 2 or 3 sequences where the gore is like spectacular. Like there's a moment where like Dracula shows up and kills like 4 guys in a room that are plotting again. That's really good. But that's kind of where it ends because...
Wait a second.
Hold on, let me finish.
Yeah, all right.
Because then here's the thing. That's all the good. But literally at the 20-minute mark, not only does it become incredibly boring, but it's almost like the movie's unfinished. Because most of those sequences have CG in them. And I mean, they are it's really bad unfinished CG. Mm-hmm. Like, unbearable that you watch and you're like, how did they let that pass? And there's just too much of it. And then the guy they chose to play Dracula is like a lot older and like the least charismatic.
He's the rapist from Stendhal Syndrome. Why bring him back? Like, I know. He's a good actor, Thomas Critchman. Yeah. But like, I don't want to see the
but
rapist.
But he is not Dracula, at all. No, he's kind of Dracula. A terrible Dracula. And so at that point, you're kind of just checked out anyway. And then so we were just commenting on the funny things like the young Ozzie Argento clone showering naked adult Ozzie Argento. We're like, yeah. Okay.
Does that change in 3D or it's just a pretty much
it's got a lot of dimension to it. Yeah. And then Rutger Hauer, who's Van Helsing.
He's like chewing the scenery through the whole movie.
He is drunk as a skunk. Like, I didn't notice it until we watched his style. Like, he just shows up and I think Miller was like, look at him stumble into the scene because he could barely talk straight. And then we notice like every time he kills a vampire, it's literally like a 10-second thing that happens almost like he like just swats once. And we were just joking, like, yeah, that's all I got in me. We're not doing, I don't know if there's fight choreography or anything, but that's all I'm doing. Like, even his fight with Dracula is pretty lackluster because you're like, he was probably so drunk is all they could get out of him. Oof. And so by the end of it, you're kind of like really bummed. And then I actually thought, I was like, when did Argento, this is Argento's last movie. This is the last thing he made. And it was only 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 2012.
Yep.
And so that was devastatingly heartbreaking and terrible.
Yeah, that's a bummer.
Yeah.
If you see it at all, try to see it in 3D because at least it looks really cool. And it was shot properly with 3D cameras, meaning that everything in frame is in focus, which is how your eyes see stuff.
So you felt devastated by that. And you were like, on the mummy.
I Frankenstein. I don't know how much you want to talk about this, Ryan, because I know that.
Wait, which one is that? Is that the one with Aaron Eckhart? I didn't see that.
Holy shit. We were like flabbergasted because, all right, first of all, so the whole Frankenstein legend is summed up very briskly in like the first minute and a half, like the whole movie.
Yeah.
So, like, oh, cool. It's Frankenstein 2. Here's the sequel. And then they go into it. This has kind of been my problem with the Underworld movies is that they take it way too seriously that I just think it's stupid. I'm like, this is ridiculous. I Frankenstein goes even further because instead of monsters, it's him in the middle of a war between gargoyles and demons. Oh, and also here's the other thing. I think the whole movie is third act scenes. Like there's an epic battle within the first 5 minutes. And we're like, wait a minute. Are we at the end of the movie? Like, I don't know what's happening. And like, you know, the Gargoyle Queen gets kidnapped. And we're like, is this the end of the movie?
The Gargoyle Queen.
What a weird choice.
But then,
why is there a Gargoyle Queen in Frankenstein?
Oh, Jesus. I don't know. Okay. It's just a war between gargoyles.
Because the lichens and vampires were unavailable.
Yeah. Exactly. But I mean,
gargoyles
here's the thing.
And Frankensteins. Let's go.
Aaron Eckhart's really giving it his all and trying to. There's no way you could sell any of this stuff. Yeah. And like, so we just were laughing out loud at things like, because, you know, the Gargoyle Queen named him Adam. So there's like one bit where somebody calls him, like, hey, Frankenstein. He's like, my name is Adam. It's the name given to me by the Gargoyle Queen. And we're like, you cannot, like, not burst out of laughter how ridiculous that is. So that happened. And then last but not least, The Mummy, which I won't spend too much time on because we talked about it when it came out. And basically, it confirmed what I initially thought, which is it's a complete misfire. It's kind of all right for the first 15 minutes or so when it's trying to it's trying to establish its story, and you're like, okay, I'm sort of with it. It's kind of an action thing, and they even have a pretty unique way of getting to the mummy. Where it completely misfires is as soon as it becomes a horror movie. And the second that she awakens, because it literally that's the point where you could start counting. All the horror movies it's ripping off. Yeah. Like, immediately, like, oh, here's American Werewolf in London. Here's Hellraiser or Life Force. Here's that movie. And more importantly, like, Tom Cruise is just not capable of playing that character. And because we said this after we saw it, I was like, that's supposed to be Bruce Campbell.
Oh, yeah.
Literally, we recited every one of Tom Cruise's lines as Bruce Campbell. And it's like, he would have sold the shit out of that. Like, for example, when the girl's like, he just comes off kind of like an asshole and arrogant. Yeah. She's like, oh, you mean hieroglyphics? And he's like, listen, I don't want to talk about your mumbo jumbo. And like, coming out of Tom Cruise, it's stupid. But I can totally see Bruce Campbell be like, listen, I don't want to talk about your mumbo jumbo. And like, and selling it, and you still sort of like him. Mm-hmm. You're still with him. So in another universe, the Dark Universe started with Bruce Campbell leading the mummy,
that
and it would have been a much better movie.
Tom Cruise rewrite. That's one of those movies you're like, okay, I could see this working, but you need to rewrite that character once you've got Tom Cruise. That's a different movie.
Well, I suspect that after doing Edge of Tomorrow, in which Tom Cruise played a coward, and it was like it began. What the, I think the pleasure centers that come out of that is seeing Tom Cruise not be the action hero at the beginning and seeing him be this kind of cowardly figure. And I think I think that kind of enabled him to go, ah, the Mummy, I could do something like that. It's just a little spin
wrong
on it,
choice.
Being a
wrong
big pulpy adventurer, you know?
Well, that's the thing. It's like that from that moment, it never recovers. Because then they shoehorn the whole Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde thing, which doesn't work at all. Yeah. And then even like the ending, I don't know what the hell. Like, I still don't understand the motivation or what happened to everybody. Quite frankly, I'm totally okay with it. I'm bummed that we're not going to get The Bride from Bill Conning, because I thought maybe he could have delivered something cool. But they just need to, you know what? Give it to guys like Del Toro, who's making The Shape in the Water, which is his Creature of the Black Lagoon.
Yeah.
That's what we really should be getting. Not
because it's also an original interpretation, not just a remake. And, you know, it's his own thing.
So
that's
we survived, barely.
Nicely done.
There you go.
I saw a couple other new movies. I saw A Bad Match, which is a pretty small indie horror, which is David, I will brutalize the name, is it Chirichillo, who was one of the writers of Cheap Thrills? And this is a film, basically it's one of the first dating, because I always think of what a great, you know, I want to see horror films set in the world of dating apps and really modern dating. I mean, this guy goes on Tinder and he changes dates all the time constantly and just sleeps with women and then leaves them in the middle of the night. They don't portray him at the start as a total asshole. He works in the tech industry. Chase Williamson is his partner in at his business. And Chase is really funny in it. The setup's nice and real. It's a very simple setup. And then basically goes on a match with a girl who he thinks acts a little crazy, and she's too into him. He becomes an asshole pretty quickly in his not wanting to call her back. And then he starts projecting a little bit. Is she fatal attractioning him, or is he making that up in his head? And things start to escalate between the two of them. And I don't necessarily think it totally worked where it went, but I thought the ride was pretty good. Like especially for a simple, small indie, I enjoyed it. Like it's not, you know, it's not aiming that high for what it's trying to do. It's a very simple, self-contained story, but it works for the budget and stuff. I thought it was kind of cool. I think I would have liked it to maybe be more horror. Like I feel like it wasn't pushing the horror side of it enough,
right?
And then it all kind of comes at the very end of the movie. But you know, it wasn't a bad one. And then I saw one that was really well made, but I realized I might have outgrown these kind of movies. The Killing Ground is on Netflix right now. It's kind of basically, I call it Last Tent on the Left. It's basically Wolf Creek if you took out the charm of Mick. And that's when I realized I don't need those movies in my life anymore. Like, this is well made. The director's not doing anything wrong. It's just the kind of story it is. It's set in Australia in the outback. There's a camping trip. A couple are going camping. They see a tent next to them that the family never come back to. And then you're seeing flashbacks to, so it's kind of like time jumps to see what that family's going through leading up to something bad you know is going to happen. Then you meet these two kind of, you know, two guys in the same world as Mick, but like a lot kind of just nastier, and there's nothing charming or funny about them. It's just kind of grim, and they kind of they obviously go after this first family that's no longer present, and then you're in the current story with the characters you followed camping and realizing, oh, now they're gonna have to square off against these people. And then as I watch it, I'm just watching them going, it's just like, it's cool, it's really well done, the acting's good, but you're like, the survivalist intense horror that I used to probably be, I know Rob's not usually a big fan of those. I usually rather like them. It's totally fine watching it, but there's something in me that goes, I don't know if I need this anymore. Like this kind of movie, it's just dark. I don't know it's trying to get across to me. You know?
But the last 10 minutes though?
The last couple minutes, pretty fun. The character shift is pretty interesting.
The character shift is really good.
The character shift is, but I don't know. Maybe it's just something about the pleasure you derive from horror. Maybe it was changing for me. Like, cause at least with Wolf Creek, you have, even though it's grim, you still have this character who's, I don't just mean charm as in humor. He's constantly fascinating.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Take that out, and I think it's just a little just grim.
Yeah.
You know, and I felt that's how I felt about this film.
I had a gasp moment for me. Uh-huh. There was a moment with a child that really, really worked. I think the director is really solid, and I'm very curious to see what he does when it's not in the survival horror world now.
Yeah, no, it was perfectly well made. And I think if you're into movies like that, or like, you know, Kidnapped or home invasion movies and things, it's definitely might hit those sweet spots, but I think they're a little, I would say Hounds of Love from this year is a lot more interesting, a movie with a similar kind of tone. It's not, again, that's not a masterpiece either in my opinion, but it's interesting. Did you see Hounds of Love?
Not yet.
Okay. See, I think that one's just, the characters are just more engaging, I guess.
Yeah.
But a lot of those kind of movies coming out of Australia right now.
Yeah.
I saw, and I think Elric talked about this probably a year ago, and it took me a while to see it. But you literally at the time said this is, movie was made for Becca, The Rift from 1990, which
by the guy who made Pieces.
Yeah, it's and Slugs.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And so his name is Jean Picard. I'm going to say that wrong. Simon. This is from 1990. And this was a year after what I'll call the aquatic horror boom, where we had Leviathan, The Abyss, and Lords of the Deep, like back to back. And all of which I absolutely loved. And so Elric had said, you know, this is like one of your favorite directors made an aquatic horror film, which for some reason I had never heard of. But the whole concept of it, I'd never heard of it until Elric told me. And then it's been on my queue for a while and I finally watched it.
Was it on Amazon? Is that where
It's on Amazon. I think it was like $2 to rent. And but I absolutely loved it. I will say the beginning part almost lost me because for the first half of the movie, when it's setting everything up, you find out that they're all in a submarine and they're all about to go down. And of course, there's like rivalry between the hot guy that they bring in to like talk about the sub because he piloted the prior sub that blew up. And then his ex-wife or ex-girlfriend or somebody he used to sleep with is on the ship. So you've got this tension. And
Arlie Emery.
Yeah, Arlie Emery is the commander of the whole thing. So he's there to like tell everybody that they suck balls and yell at them. And but you find out that they are on this particular ship. And there was a prior version of this submarine that was going down deep into this like super deep rift trench thing and disappeared. And nobody knows what happened to it. And so theirs is like a reconnaissance mission. It's like to go down and try to figure out what happened to the first one. And what they find out was that there was kind of this scientific experiment. I won't give too much away. But once they get there, they find this kind of underwater area and it's full of creatures. And there's this like genetic testing that had been going on. And then it turns into a creature feature. And then I was in. The first third is literally them on this submarine looking at computer screens, but it's 1990. So they're not interesting computer screens, but it's them looking and going, do you see this, Sergeant? And it's like a red dot blinking. And then he's like, yes, that means that it's the black box of the prior ship and we should go in that direction. And then a second red dot will creep across the screen. And I'm just like, oh.
But yeah, then the first third has that aesthetic and performance style where if they all just started fucking, like it became softcore Emmanuel in space, it wouldn't surprise
you. You would
it
just be like, okay.
Like that. Like okay. It could just go that direction.
Yeah, it's because it feels, it's very plastic. It felt like, you know, they literally built one set of submarine commander console and then everything happens there. And so for the first third, I'm like, this has to go somewhere or else Elric wouldn't have been so enthusiastic about it. And then the creatures show up and I'm like, fuck yes, this is where
that's
it
where all
is.
The money went, not the submarine.
No, because the creatures are fun. And I mean, they're 1990. It's like, you know, they're still low budget and they're still very practical where it's like rubber monsters, but they are fun rubber monsters and some really innovative creature ideas that I hadn't seen before. So,
Becca,
yeah.
I got to say, you had a good diverse week in terms of viewing. You had Satanists and orgies and aquatic monsters.
Still very on point for me, though.
Yeah. Very on brand.
And a book. I'm about to get to the book I read. So, excellent. Yeah. But The Rift, yeah, it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. Don't expect it to be like Citizen Kane level horror, but if you're just looking for a good cheesy monster flick, hold with it for the first 30 minutes while they're descending. Once they actually get down and the monsters show up, it's fun.
Or just ask Becca what chapter mark to jump to and just jump.
Just go.
Yeah, it looks like Kino Lorber put this out on Blu-ray and it's The Rift, aka Endless Descent.
Endless Descent.
It's the alternate title, if you will.
I'd love to read something about him as a director. I mean, given the movies he's made are so wild.
Yeah, Pieces, Slugs, and The Rift, and all three. Oh, and he made Cthulhu Mansion. I think that was him. I got to Google that. Let me check that before I say
it
that.
It just seems like he feels like one of those directors there's probably a real story behind. Yeah. Like, there's probably something. I do know the producer of Pieces, like, you know, ripped everyone off and then took off to Mexico and was never seen again. Like, no one, rights to that were a problem at some point because he just disappeared.
Right.
But, I love movies like that.
So I'm going to double check, but I think he did Cthulhu Mansion. But proceed, and I will get back to you.
I have two other titles. One is The Limehouse Golem, which came out this year.
That's one McGarris recently posted about, right?
Did he really?
Yeah, I think he said he really liked it.
It was something that kind of just got ushered onto VOD unceremoniously. Juan Carlos Medina directed it. I think they shot it last year, came out this year. Olivia Cooke stars along with Bill Nighy, period piece. set in London before the Jack the Ripper murders. Basically, you've got a maniac running around town, chopping people up, and they all suspect it's that. Well, they don't know who the killer is, but he keeps signing off as the Gollum. Everybody's like, the Gollum? Who's the Gollum? And Bill Nighy has been tasked to find out who the killer is. He turns to Olivia Cooke, who is a woman suspected of murdering her husband, poisoning him. And Bill sees a connection between her and the Gollum in terms of following kind of like the trail of breadcrumbs of why he suspects her husband was the killer. And if he can peel away at her emotional layers and get into the relationship between the two, she might provide clues as to who her husband was for real. And so we kind of bounce back and forth between present day, their present day, and the past of her going, being raised in this abusive relationship with her mother, and then getting admitted into this acting troupe and performing with all these actors, and somehow all the actors are all suspects of being the Gollum, da da da. So they kind of bounce back and forth. And it's a really beautiful movie, and it's purely a procedural tale, not necessarily scary, incredibly gory. If Fangoria was still around, I'm sure one of the gore gags would be on the front page. But at the end of the day, I was just like completely let down, because I just felt like it led us down a trail that wasn't very exciting, and it was and the reveal of what. There was like a big reveal in the last 20 minutes, and it just wasn't. I told Ciara, I was like, it began like a period piece 7, because Bill Nighy is kind of like a washed up detective, and
as Jack the Ripper period, and
The Ripper period, and he's paired with this kind of new detective who's out to prove himself, and da da da, and they're kind of piecing the clues together. But it was just like, I don't really care about any of this. I wasn't emotionally invested in any of it. So I know you telling me, Mick, that Mick liked it. He's not the only one. I've run into a bunch of people that are like, this is surprisingly good, but just didn't impress me.
What was the name again?
The Limehouse Gollum.
I'm just calling that the Gollum. I'd want to see it as soon as it's called the Limehouse Gollum.
Well, I'm looking at the synopsis, and it's very misleading. A series of murders has shaken the community to the point where people believe that only a legendary creature from dark times, the mythical Gollum, must be responsible. There's no fucking creature in this.
Yeah.
But there might be the perception of the people.
I didn't feel there was a perception. That's where they're wrong. And then I'll just pair it up with another Debbie Downer review. I watched the Resurrected from 1991 with Chris Sarandon.
I have that sitting on my two-watch shelf.
Holy bonkers.
Oh, God.
Dan O'Bannon.
Did you watch
the restored version?
No, watched whatever I just popped in, because I've never seen it.
It's the director's cut.
Is it the director's cut?
Yeah, that's the director's.
Well, there you go. That's what I watched. Thanks, Shout Factory, Scream Factory. It's the Charles Dexter Ward story. Yeah. Chris Sarandon giving it his all. Yeah. The lead actor who plays this like private eye. It's so fucking 1991, man. It is so like, it begins with the PI, and he's enlisted by this married woman. And of course, like the coverage of it is like, the woman walks in, and he looks immediately down at her finger. Oh, she's got a wedding band. Maybe I should flirt. Maybe I shouldn't. And then she opens the door for a little flirtation. And then she mentions her husband, and she kind of shuts the PI down. And then it's like, okay, I see how complex this movie is going to get. Chris Sarandon comes in. Yay, he's going to save the day and maybe save this movie. But he's sorely misused, I feel.
But the sequences with the actual creature.
But the sequences with the actual awesome. Like Lovecraftian
horror.
Yes,
everything
horror,
Lovecraftian is awesome. Everything
fucking
else
does cool
not.
As shit, man.
It is a bummer in that way.
There is some really great nightmarish monstrosities that are created, but I couldn't tell you what the fuck this movie is about, honestly. It's just a very bizarre one.
Wow.
Yeah, there's some weird mental hospital sequences too.
Well, it begins in a mental hospital, much like Reanimator,
in the
mouth
of
madness.
A bunch
of people come running in, and they're like, "Oh my god, you got to open the cell!" And they open the cell, and it's blood everywhere, and there's a corpse, and there's a severed head somewhere else, and a broken window, and they're like, "How did this happen?" Blue, blue, blue. And then we go back in time, and we figure it out.
Wow.
But I still think that one's worth our people listening checking out, because the monster stuff is so good. And it's Lovecraft,
Elric, so frustrating that they get the Lovecraft people on five minutes of screen time. But, do not sell them on 5 minutes
of screen time. But the Lovecraft
elements,
they actually get right for a change, which is always so hard to do. But it's the movie they get wrong. They get the, like, the, I don't care about that kind of, the character there looks like he could exist in the same world as Nightflyer. Nightflyer is a much better movie. But you know how the Nightflyer also has that kind of cheesy palette of the actual world being, I work in an office and I'm a journalist.
It feels like a pulp novel.
And there's also a voiceover. And so he's just like, she came to me on a rainy night.
90s neo-noir, but yeah, in a horror, it's kind of weird. But
oh, and I double-checked, and the guy who directed Pieces, Slugs, and The Rift also did do Cthulhu Mansion.
Wow. Boom. We have that's that a Slashback video.
Yes, connection. And you have my copy of Slashback Video.
Oh, that's your copy.
That's my copy of Cthulhu Mansion.
Anything else, Becky? You read something?
Yeah, so I've been doing a project for a company on young adult horror novels. And so I've been reading young adult horror novels like a lot lately. And so most of them, I'm kind of like, yep, those are teenagers in peril. And then this one I really, really liked. So I had to talk about it on the show. It is called The May Queen Murders. Just came out earlier this year by Sarah Jude. And it's set in the Ozarks, which I really don't know much about, but I started.
See the show The Ozarks.
I know. I need to watch it. Dave watches it, but I've never caught it. But I ended up researching the Ozarks and the community, and it sounds very much like Appalachian area, how kind of isolated and rural it is in that regard.
Can I stop you for 1 second? Because you mentioned the Ozark. So I never even heard of Ozark until that show on Netflix. And I forgot to mention that the Linda Blair Wes Craven movie that I watched 2 weeks in summer is set in Ozark.
That's the,
Whoa. So it keeps just coming up.
Yeah. The the only thing I knew about the Ozarks from before was I was watching the movie California with a K a couple of months ago.
Shave that dog, teach to hunt.
At the very beginning, when they pull up and they see Brad Pitt and Juliette Lewis standing there and they're getting ready to pick him up, she turns to him and says, oh my God, they look like Okies. And so I Googled what an Okie was. And then it was like, people from the Ozarks. And I was like,
I thought Okies were people from Oklahoma, from the John Steinbeck novel. I thought that's where Okies
I think
from.
That, well, Oklahoma is
new. Says the guy from New Zealand.
Yeah, way to go.
Hey, I've read the book.
When I Googled it, the indication was that it was like a derogatory term for poor rural people.
They should
in
be Ozies.
The Ozarks. The Ozies.
Not Okies.
Ozark's making a huge comeback. That's
anyway,
what I'm saying right now.
Ozarks. This coming is up set Ozark. In the Ozarks. And it's about a girl who lives in, I don't even know how to describe it, like we have them in Virginia, but I'll describe it as like a hippie commune, but it isn't like a hippie commune. It's just a group of people who have kind of always lived in this little area, like a glen, which is what they call it in the movie, or a valley. And you refer to yourself as being valley folk. And then people who live over here, like there's trailer park people, but they call them rollers. And then they have the townies. So the town itself is very divided. And they have a couple of murders kind of occur within this little glen that they live in. And they keep in thinking that it has to be people from outside because no one in the glen would do this. But it ultimately becomes kind of a slasher but a murder mystery at the same time, all from the setting of a 16-year-old girl. And so it's really cool as she's kind of like watching everything unfold around her. And the girl who it's like she's watching and it catches her right at a moment where like because she's 15, 16, she's just starting to get interested in boys, but her best friend has clearly kind of matured more quickly. So her best friend is kind of wild and off doing drugs and drinking and everything. But again, they're from this kind of very isolated environment. So when she finds out that her best friend's sleeping with this guy from the trailer park, you know, she doesn't know how to approach it. Does she tell people? And so it's a lot about kind of puberty, but it's puberty as these murders are taking place.
Yeah. I would like to borrow this one.
You may. It's really cool.
The May Queen Murders.
The May Queen Murders. I really enjoyed it. And it's because it's YA lit, I guess it, you know, it's written for teenagers, but I literally read it in about 5 hours. So,
and if we have
but
any
I couldn't
listeners,
put it down. Like, I literally just binged through the whole book.
Any
it was
listeners
great.
From the Ozarks, I would love to hear from you. What are you referring to? Are you as trashy as we are making you out to look and media portrayals?
They don't portray them like that in
oh, really?
This. I mean, okay, they have people in the trailer park, but they actually, the people who live in the Glen, which was nice. It's this very insular community, which I will describe as like a hippie commune, where they're all named after nature, like Ivy and Laurel and Pine, and they're all kind of that, but they don't portray them as being flaky or weird. They just portray them as like wonderful people who are shocked when these murders start happening.
Okay.
And it's actually a really good portrayal of the environment.
Cool.
So. Nice. Before we wrap up and go to our guest, I just want to say really quick two things. One, I purchased Night School based on Ryan's recommendation.
Yes.
It is everything you said it was and more.
Yep.
I was blown away by the long suspenseful moment that you're telling me about because it was one of those, when is it going to happen?
Where's it going to find it?
Where? So Night School is legit.
Yeah.
I just wanted to back you up
fucking
on that one.
Awesome.
From Warner Archive. And lastly, I just want to say I picked up Arrow put out the George Romero set called From Night to Dawn, which is his early films. It's the Season of the Witch.
There's Always Vanilla.
There's Always Vanilla and The Crazies. I have not watched the movies themselves yet, but I dug into the special features for the set, and I got to tell you, it's really terrific. On the first disc, there was two pieces. One's called Affair of the Heart, because that was the original name of There's Always Vanilla's The Affair.
Oh.
And it's all new interviews with you know, pretty much all the people that helped make Night of the Living Dead, and kind of, you know, this is a fascinating period that we don't know a lot about in terms of George's history. And so I just thought, wow, this is super cool. And the movies, like the clips that were in there, looked like they really went back and restored them. And then there's a candid piece with George that I think was from the Anchor Bay DVD where he basically is like, I wish nobody would ever find these movies. Like, I didn't have a good time with them, et cetera, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But they're super cool. And then on the second disc was an hour-long interview when Romero met Del Toro. And it's literally just Guillermo and George sitting on a couch chatting. It's about a year ago. So it's actually, sadly, very close to before he passed. And George isn't as animated as usually. I mean, he's so happy just that he's there, but Del Toro, as usual, does most of the talking. But it is a really fun chat, and it was just super cool to see. And again, it's like, I kind of like that the set exists, and now, you know, they just announced Criterion's doing Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
So it's great to see George, especially early George work, coming out and getting kind of restored and you know, available to us. So kudos to Arrow for that box set. I think it's pretty great.
And I'll quickly end by saying, Elric, we were both right.
What about?
The term Okie does refer to people in Oklahoma.
In case you were wondering.
In case you were curious, it actually originated during the Dust Bowl.
Great Depression,
and it refers to people from Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas, and Missouri.
Okie dokie.
So it was originally people from Oklahoma, but it's everybody in that kind of Dust Bowl region.
The more you know.
And I just want to give a shout out to Stephen Greger, who sent everybody on the team his first issue of his zine, What Monster, an almanac for the horror movie Anorak. And the first issue is on Friday the 13th. This originated in England. So check out at What Monster Mag on Instagram and Twitter for more information.
Great.
I can't wait to dig into this.
Hear from our sponsors, and we'll be right back. This episode is sponsored by Fright Rags. Right now, they have a brand new Creepshow collection, including shirts and hoodies. And they also have an all-new Jigsaw collection in honor of the Saw sequel.
And check out the officially licensed trick-or-treat and Halloween lines on shirts, pins, and more.
Yeah, and they have the General Mill line still, including the awesome t-shirts and, you know, these monster cereals, which, again, I don't think, Elric, you're familiar with monster cereals.
How do you know?
We didn't have
cereals?
Them there, but I did know them.
You knew
the pop icon.
Yeah. Well, look, you know the deal with Fright Rags. All the artwork is custom. It's made by top horror artist talents. And right now you can get 10% off your next order. Just enter Shockwaves1217 at checkout.
And Ryan's actually wearing a Creepshow shirt right now, which is super cool.
This episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder, brought to you by AMC Networks. Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thrillers, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals, and there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore.
New this week on Shudder is Another Evil. After encountering a ghost in their vacation home, Dan and his wife Mary consult an exorcist. Unsatisfied with the verdict, Dan goes behind his wife's back to seek a second opinion and secretly hires Oss, who promises to get rid of the beings. Oss and Dan spend a week together in the vacation home, excising the evil beings, but Dan soon realizes that ridding the home of evil simply won't be as simple as it seems.
Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership. But our listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. Just enter promo code SHOCK, S-H-O-C-K, at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
Okay, and welcome back to the show. And I'm very excited by this particular guest because it's somebody that we've wanted to have on the show for quite a while, as we say very often. But it's true, and also I've recently been working with this gentleman, so which is the first time we met, and now it's kind of like, oh, how did we not know each other all this time? I'm talking, of course, about the director of Psycho Cop Returns, Riff Coogan, who's here.
That's how he likes to lead with.
Yes. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's the other name that you go by, but this is actually Adam Rifkin. Welcome, Adam Rifkin.
Hello.
To the show.
Happy to be here. We both are happy to be here.
Should we start there? Who's Riff Coogan? How'd this happen?
When I was first starting out, I just thought it would be funny and cool to have a alter ego, sort of nom de plume.
Yeah.
So I wanted to direct more sort of mainstream movies under my name, Adam
right.
Rifkin. And I wanted to have a whole grindhouse career making exploitation movies under the name Riff Coogan. Riff Coogan, the name deriving from my nickname as a kid, Riff, because of Rifkin.
Yeah.
And Coogan from Coogan's Bluff,
yeah, good movie.
The Clint Eastwood yeah. movie, right.
Wow.
It's very Stephen King, Richard Bachman of it.
Yes, exactly. But there's only a couple of Riff Coogan movies.
Well,
and I know Psycho Cop Returns, but what's The Invisible Maniac?
The Invisible Maniac was the first Riff Coogan movie. And I have to say, I had planned to do a whole slew of them. There is one unproduced Riff Coogan script that was written at the time that I still plan to make called Bloodbath a Go-Go.
Nice.
About strippers dying off one by one in a strip club one night.
Herschel Gordon Lewis.
Yeah,
very,
yeah,
very
totally
inspired
Herschel
Gordon Lewis. But I'll tell you, making The Invisible Maniac and Psycho Cop Returns were two of the most fun times I ever had making movies because the stakes are so low.
Yeah.
Nobody. Yes. I mean, if something goes wrong, we just thought it was funny. Yeah. But on a big movie that a lot of money is being spent and something that you care so much about, yeah. It's so stressful when something's going wrong. But on Invisible Maniac, when one of the actors would forget their lines, we just thought it was funny and moved on.
Yeah. Well, I just want to say
wow.
that as someone who just saw Psycho Cop Returns
yes.
this year for the first time, thanks to a copy I got of Texas Frightmare.
Vinegar Syndrome.
I constantly drive through Burbank on my way home and I go, that's the building.
That's the
psycho.
Building.
That this is the street.
Wait,
that's
where?
Where they fall.
It's right near the Burbank Center. It's right off San Fernando.
Oh, wow.
It's the black square, glass building.
Yeah.
Holy smokes. Should we start with Psycho Cop Returns and then go
Why
back?
Not?
Why not?
Why are you there? Why was I so pleasantly surprised? Because I got that from Vinegar Syndrome and had yeah. no idea that it was you until I watched the special features and there you are talking about it. I'm like, it's Adam Rifkin. Okay. But obviously, this is a sequel. And so
none of us have heard of the first one.
Psycho Cop.
No. I literally said to my girlfriend, she's like, what are we watching? I'm like, Psycho Cop Returns. She's like, this looks fun. What's it a sequel to? I'm like, I think it's just its own thing.
I
thought it was just Psycho Cop 2 or Psycho Cop Returns. And I was like, I don't know if there was a first one. I think he's just
like
returning.
Leonard 6.
Yeah.
There is a Psycho Cop 1.
Yeah.
Right.
And I never saw it.
Oh,
that's probably the way to do it.
But you brought back the Psycho Cop, yeah. right? It's the same guy.
It's the same guy. Okay, he starred in Psycho Cop 1.
So he's your continuity.
Did he take you to task on canon at any point where he was like, I lost my hand in part one. Why do I have this back? Or was he just like, whatever, man?
He was so cool. His name's Bobby Ray Schaefer. He's a great guy. We still know each other. He actually had a big role on The Office. You'd recognize him. He's been in a lot of stuff. But, He just was cool going with the flow because I had never seen the first one. The writer is my friend Dan Povenmire, who has gone on to actually create Phineas and Ferb and a lot of big Disney franchises. But I don't even think he saw the first one. So we just kind of felt free to just embrace the character and do what we wanted. And the hardcore Psycho Cop 1 fans didn't seem too upset.
So right. And was Maniac Cop in your mind at all? Because that was before these, right?
Maniac Cop is whoever made Psycho Cop 1, Maniac Cop was in their mind.
Ah.
And they ripped off Maniac Cop in creating Psycho Cop 1.
Right.
But and I, of course, was aware of the Maniac Cop movies, and I think they're great. But I wasn't the one who thought, let's rip off Maniac Cop. Yeah. I just sort of went with the flow and made Psycho Cop Return.
Excellent. Which also has an amazing sequence that it was so weird because when I first watched it, I also got the Vinegar Syndrome disc. It was right after I watched that big documentary on like the LA riots and stuff. So I had just watched a thing about Rodney King.
Yeah.
And you reference it in such a kind of amazingly satirical way in
well,
your
that,
movie.
That was our attempt at being political and topical,
timely, yeah.
and controversial.
Right.
Because at the end of the movie, I mean, everybody at that time had seen the Rodney King videotape over and over and over and over again. Rodney King being beaten up by all these white cops.
Yeah.
Right? So we thought it would be controversial and political to have Psycho Cop, a white cop, being beaten up by all these black guys.
Yes.
So, but there were some white guys in the crowd too. But anyway, just seeing the cop get beaten up by all these people, a reverse on the Rodney King video.
Right. So inadvertently, I did the most weird, bizarre double feature of all time. That documentary in your movie.
That's right. That's what was how it's meant to be seen.
Yes, of course. You were like 20 years from now. I hope somebody sees that.
I will tell you this, if I may. You say 20 years from now. Mm. When we were making Psycho Cop 2, I never thought the term Psycho Cop 2 would be uttered by anyone 20 years later.
Yeah.
I thought it was purely disposable. It was going to be seen, digested, shat out, and never again spoken of.
Yes.
Within a month after we finished it. But
the power of Blu-ray.
I love it.
But here is this beautiful Blu-ray with a gorgeous slipcase made of the hardest material and it's shiny. I was actually looking at it the other day. And
it's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
It's
a piece of work.
I'm shocked. And by the way, and thrilled and honored. It's been a lot of fun. I had no idea it had fans.
I think when we talked about this a couple episodes ago, I think it was just a great time capsule of a time in which we were all growing up. And our tastes were shaping. We were Fangoria loving kids. Julie Strain was an awesome queen.
Yeah, of course.
Rhonda Shear would have hosted this movie on USA Up All Night. It was just a very formative type movie. And it was just great tripping down memory lane, having never seen it before. And then going, oh, this is exactly what I would have liked.
Well, that's cool.
Eaten pizza too and drank
great.
A whole lot of Mountain Dew and just like dreamt very fondly of Julie Strain that night.
That's great.
Well, I want to go back to the beginning, but I also want to note, because this is the interesting thing about your filmography is I think much like, you know, John Landis is kind of pegged as one of the Masters of Horror guys, even though most of his body of work is comedy and not really like, you know, but he made American Werewolf in London. And you have a similar thing where you made movies like Detroit Rock City and The Chase. And there's some horror in there, but not a lot. And yet I still consider you one of the horror guys.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. Horror is my first love.
Yeah.
I grew up loving movies because I loved horror movies first.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, my introduction to horror movies came from Svengoolie. I grew up in Chicago. And Svengoolie,
I lived there for a while, and Svengoolie was great. He's still going.
He's
like
still doing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he still is. That's
he's
great.
Still doing. He's awesome, on MeTV every Saturday night across the country, which is so comforting to me when I watch him every Saturday night here in L.A. But I saw all the Universal horror movie, all the monster movies from Universal on Svengoolie. I saw all the Hammer horror films on Svengoolie. I saw all the AIP drive-in movies on Svengoolie. All the Japanese giant monster movies on Svengoolie. Everything I saw first on Svengoolie. And so, and the movies that I made as a kid growing up with my neighborhood friends were always horror movies.
Hmm.
And it's interesting that I've made so few horror movies in my adult life because I love it. I have such a fondness for it, but I haven't really. And by the way, even the horror that I've done is all kind of comedy horror.
Mm-hmm.
None of it is truly horror. Mm. And I really would love to do a straight up scary as hell horror movie. And I plan to do that at some point.
So what's your subgenre of choice?
My sentimental favorite is always going to be the Universal monster movies.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the ones that connected to and related to those misunderstood monsters. You know, they all had such pathos. I didn't understand that concept when I was a kid. I just felt like these monsters are my friends. I wish that they would be, I could hang out with them and scare all the, you know, my my friends at school with my pet monsters. But then I really started to evolve into loving all kinds of horror movies, and then loving all kinds of movies just period as I got older. You know?
Well, where did it start for you? Because obviously you did a lot of writing, you did, obviously you've directed, but which thing did you pursue first? And because you said you made films with your friends in high school. So were you aiming to be a writer or a director or both? Or
I always wanted to be a film director. When I was 5, 6, 7 years old and making movies with my sister and my friends with my father's Super 8 film camera, I didn't write the scripts. I just shot stuff as we just made it up as we went along. And to me, that was the fun of making movies, was shooting. And I really kind of turned to writing out of necessity, because I knew that nobody was going to let me direct something. I moved out to LA when I was 17, and I figured out pretty early on that there was no magic to getting a movie made. You just needed the money, and then you could make a movie. Mm-hmm. And then you needed more money than you need now. I mean, you can make a movie super cheap now. But in those days, you still needed a lot of money, even if it was a tiny movie. And so I just started knocking on doors trying to get money to get movies made. But I knew nobody would let me direct one if I didn't have something written that they liked. Mm. And I remember the story of Rocky. I remember when I was first writing scripts, that Sylvester Stallone wrote it and they wanted to buy it. And he said, the only way I'll let you buy it is if I can star in it.
Yeah.
And they wanted it so badly, they agreed to let him star in it. And I thought, well, if I write a script that somebody wants badly enough, they'll let me direct it. Mm. Which, of course, didn't quite work out. That I guess it did kind of work out that way, but it's not because they wanted it so badly. It's because I was so cheap that they could they knew they could make a super cheap movie and pay me nothing. That's how I got my first movie made.
And what was your first job in the business?
My first, this is going to sound bad. I mean, this is going to sound lame. I mean, it's going to sound like I'm patting myself on the back. The first job I ever had professionally in Hollywood was writing and directing a movie.
Okay.
Wow. You didn't PA or spend a year getting
coffee.
You
went right to it.
I never did. I got very lucky when I was 19. The first script I ever wrote was a script called The Dark Backward. And I knew when I was writing, it's a very sort of oddball kind of movie. And I knew that I was never going to be able to afford movie stars or big special effects, but I thought my production value could be something, if I did something unusual enough, that would make it stand out. I wanted something to stand out from other movies. So I wrote this movie called The Dark Backward about a stand-up comedian who grows a third arm. And I didn't really know how to pursue finding money for a movie. So I was knocking on doors of like lawyers and dentists whoever had like the biggest ad for their business in the Yellow Pages. I kid you not, I would go and knock on their door and say, and I thought to myself, well, they can afford a full page ad in the Yellow Pages. They must be rich. They'll want to fund a movie. None of them, of course, did. And for some reason, this one lawyer who I approached took pity on me. And it was exciting to me because he was the lawyer who had been involved somehow with the original deal on Easy Rider.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
And so I thought, hey, real Hollywood, right? So he sat me down and he said, look, you're going about this all wrong. You don't go to lawyers and doctors and dentists for money. There are production companies that do this. You approach them professionally and they'll assess your material and then they'll see if they want to fund your movie. So there was no internet then, so I had to research who the production companies were. You'd have to get like a book. I think it was like a Hollywood 411.
Like a guide.
A guide. And so I approached all these different production companies with this script, and they all said no. But one of them was a company called Scurus Pictures, no longer exists. And they said no. But the reader at that company went to high school with a producer, young producer. I was 19. They were like 21. So John Lau was the reader. John Lau went to high school with this kid named Brad Wyman, who had just produced his first movie called White of the Eye, directed by Donald Campbell.
Oh, I talk about it all the time.
We like that movie a lot.
Great movie, right? Great movie. So that was Brad's first
opportunity. A 21-year-old producer that?
Brad and Cassian Elwes produced it together. Crazy. For
Cassian?
Yeah.
Wait, wow. Is this Brad that is now just did the Rob Zombie movie?
Yes.
Okay. He's friends with me on Facebook. Okay, I talk to him all the time.
That's him, right.
Okay.
So Brad and Cassian at the time, Cassian Elwes, who's produced a million great movies, and he's got a big Oscar contender this year, Mudbound, he produced. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they were kids working for Cassian's stepfather, Elliot Kastner.
Wait, Brad runs a crowdfunding campaign company now, right?
Now, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
So Cassian and Brad were working for Elliot Kastner. Elliot Kastner, classic old-time producer, produced a lot of Paul Newman movies, Brando movies, Richard Burton movies. And Elliot was cranking out a lot of low-budget genre movies at that time. So they said, let's bring – so John Lau went to Brad Wyman and said, I read a script you would like because you like out there stuff. He gave it to Brad. Brad read it. Brad called me because my number was on the script. He brought me in to Elliot's office. He said, look, I just made my first movie. I want to produce more movies. Elliot, who's my boss, he's funding small movies. Let me be the producer. You be the writer and director. So that was exciting to me because that's what I wanted. And he said, let's see if we can get Elliot to fund the movie. So I said, great. So he gave it to Elliot, and Elliot did not like it at all. He said, this movie's weird. It won't make any money. He said, but if you have a script for the kids, he said, do you have a script for the kids? Like he meant teenagers, right? If you have a script for the kids, I'll let you direct a movie if you have a script for the kids, the kids will like. So, and by the way, Elliot produced one of my favorite movies. There's a poster of it in this building on the wall, The Long Goodbye.
Yeah. One of the great best. Movie. Yeah.
So anyway, I said, I do have a script for the kids. He said, well, bring it in tomorrow. I said, can I just tweak it a little bit and bring it to you next week? Sure. So I ran home and I wrote one. So this was like a Tuesday. I went by Monday. I had a script that was like a teen comedy and I brought it in. And Elliot, I don't think he even read it. He just asked Brad and Cassian, will the kids like it? Yeah. Okay, you can make it. And so he funded my first movie when I was 19.
Which one was that?
That was called Never on Tuesday.
Never on Tuesday. And so you wrote that pretty much like overnight?
I wrote it in 5 days.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
How does that one hold up? Have you watched it again recently?
It's hard for me to watch. Okay. It's hard for me to watch. I'll tell you, some people, for a while it was streaming on Netflix. It's no longer streaming on Netflix. I cringe when I watch it. Some people have told me they liked it. I don't necessarily believe them. Yeah. They're being kind. But it was a great first movie experience for me. Got the ball rolling. We had some great cameos because Cassian and Brad grew up with the Brat Pack. So they were their friends. So Charlie Sheen did a small role in it. Nicolas Cage did a small role. Emilio Estevez, Judd Nelson. They all did cameos in it. But that got the ball rolling and enabled me to be able to tell people I was a seasoned writer-director.
Okay, so this is uncredited on your IMDb, but did you do Going Overboard after you wrote that?
I was not a writer or a director on that movie. My then girlfriend, Valerie Brayman, who is a very talented writer-director, she wrote and directed that movie.
Yes.
I don't know. Does it say that I'm involved as a writer on that?
It says you're uncredited as a writer.
I was not a writer on that movie.
And for those of you that don't know, this is literally like the first Adam Sandler movie.
That's right.
And they after he kind of broke big with like Big Daddy and all those movies, it got released on DVD and it was sold as the lost, first Adam Sandler movie. And it's got a ton of people, Billy Zane, Billy Bob Thornton, like all these like very recognizable famous
people.
It's
true. And
before that.
Valerie wrote and directed that in 1 week. at 23 years old. She's since gone on to direct and write a lot of great stuff. She wrote and directed Love and Sex, where John Favreau plays me and Famke Jensen plays Valerie.
Now we can watch that.
That's
movie.
A good movie.
It's a really good movie.
It's a really smart movie. I remember that one.
Oh man.
So did that did your team just roll straight from that film right into Dark Backward?
No.
Okay, so it still took a long time.
Yeah, every single project. I mean, it looks like things happen fast when you look at the IMDb page, but every single movie is so hard to get made.
Yeah.
Even like Psycho Cop 2. I mean, nothing is easy. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I always fantasize if a movie is a giant hit, is suddenly the next movie super easy? I don't know. I mean, I know a lot of people who are really successful and they say it never gets easier. So
So take us on day one of your first movie. You finally banged on doors. You finally got this company to give you money for it. Were you scared out of your fucking mind? I mean, like, or were you just like this kind of, I got the confidence. I'm ready.
All right. I was very naive, you know, And so I had more confidence than I should have had.
Yeah.
But it was a very bizarre experience. We shot it out in the middle of the desert in Borrego Springs, California. And the whole crew and cast stayed at this little hotel out there, right? I was the youngest person on the crew. And the night before we were shooting, it was very embarrassing. Everybody teased me about being the youngest person on the crew. So the night before the first day of shooting, everybody was in the dining hall of this little hotel. Everybody was having dinner. Brad, the producer, was serving the food to everybody. Everybody's laughing and drinking. And somebody from the hotel came into this raucous room and got everybody's attention. Excuse me, can everybody please be quiet? Everybody quieted. Every head turned to her, and she got everybody's attention. She picked up a piece of paper and she said, "Okay, there's a phone call. Adam Rifkin, please call your mother." I never lived that one for the rest of this year. But I will tell you, the first day of production was very eye-opening for me, because I thought, when I was making tiny little movies as a kid, that I was, you know, I was just playing, and that someday I was going to learn how to make real movies. And when I got on the set of a real movie, it kind of gelled that the principles are exactly the same. You just have bigger cameras, more people to help you, more money to facilitate what you want to do, but the principles are the same. And once that kind of clicked in my mind, I felt a little more comfortable. And also, too, the DP gave me great advice that I still remember to this day, and I still think about on every movie, because when you're directing a movie, and something I didn't expect is that you're asked 8 million questions all day, every day. Mm-hmm. Do you want the toothbrush to be red or yellow? Do you want the car to be a VW or a Volvo? Do you want the hat to be a top hat or a bowler? All day, every day, right? And whatever you say, you have to own that choice. So he said to me, you're going to be hit with all these choices. And once you say yes, if you don't like it down the line, it's your fault. So be careful what you say yes to and say no to, because you can't down the line say, oh, that asshole prop guy, he messed up that prop. But if you said yes to that prop, it's your fault. So it makes me have to pause and think before I say yes or no on every decision, on every movie. And I still think about that today.
That's excellent.
Excellent advice.
Yeah.
So how did you get in the position to make The Dark Backward? Because as you said, it's a weird movie. And it probably wasn't easy to convince somebody to put up the money to make this thing. But you did end up making it happen fairly early in your career.
Yes. Well, we got real lucky with that, too. So we couldn't get that movie. And at that time, too, I wanted to make it in black and white, which was impossible at that time.
Oh, my God. That totally makes
sense.
How
are two of you?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Like Mickey One. Mickey One has the comedian, the Warren Beatty. Yeah. Similar thing.
But nobody would give us money to make that movie until Judd Nelson, at the time, was a bankable actor. And he read it and he said, I'll star in it. But I thought of Judd Nelson as a tough guy, and he wanted to play the lead, which is a real nerdy guy. Yeah. And I didn't think he could do it. I just couldn't imagine him being able to do it. And he wanted to audition for me and prove to me he could do it. Yeah. So we literally went to different comedy clubs, open mic nights around, because the character is a really bad, really shy, really nerdy stand-up comic who's not funny. And he went up in disguise.
He's Neil Hamburger. What Neil Hamburger is now, he was way ahead of the curve.
100%. Yeah. That is completely true. So he would go up on stage and in the nerdiest, most cripplingly geeky way, tell these horrible jokes, totally committed. The audience had no idea how to process what they were watching. And I thought, this guy is brave as all hell.
Yeah.
He's definitely going to play the part.
Yeah.
So that suddenly got interest in funding the movie. A company at that time called RCA Columbia and a guy named Larry Estes greenlit the movie. Now, they had just been flying high off the success of Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he suddenly got some freedom to greenlight a whole bunch of movies. And one of them was The Dark Backward. And I don't think he read it, actually.
That's also the birth of like the Sundance movie. Like,
it's
yeah,
true.
Sex
that was
Lies,
right all at
Reservoir,
that time.
Reservoir all happened right then.
Right at that time.
Huge. Living in Oblivion.
Yeah.
So, oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So he greenlit. I don't think anybody read it. And then when everybody saw it, they hated it.
What the fuck is that?
Yeah, but we got a great cast.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Paxton.
Bill Paxton was incredible in it. And James Caan and Wayne Newton and Lara Flynn Boyle. It was really a amazing time. And I had no appreciation, again, because I was so naive. I had total freedom to make that movie how I wanted. Nobody to answer to, right? Because RCA Columbia just said, if you can bring it in for this budget, go. You can do whatever you want. Hmm. And so no interference from the boys upstairs, as they say. And I had no true appreciation for how rare that is. And I learned in many movies since that that, you know, is, doesn't come along very often.
Yeah, and that artistic freedom, how did it land when the film came out? Because I know, I feel like that film has cult written all over. Like, that is going to be a modern cult movie. It probably just needs a good release at this point. Yeah. But, like, back then, and it's streaming now, right? I think I read
just
recently.
Now. Yeah. Yes, just started streaming on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, so that's great. Right. So people will be able to, like, really recently.
Yes, just when literally.
When it came out, did people like understand? Because it's like it's referencing Catskill comedians and like all of these rather obscure topics. So did people get it when it came out? Like,
very
was
few.
It really well received. Yeah.
Very few people. I mean, it got some very, very bad reviews, and it got some very, very good reviews. And so the company that released it, Grey Cat, and the reason we were excited about going with them is because they had just released Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Yeah.
And so they made the ad campaign a quote from a great review, quote from a bad review, quote from, you know, it's like the greatest movie I've ever seen, the worst movie I've ever seen. You know, I mean,
so Street Trash did too.
Yeah.
Street Trash.
And so, so that was kind of the strategy, and it had some fans. I mean, what's interesting: the creative people that I admired at the time who saw it really liked it, and that made me feel really good.
Yeah.
But everybody in Hollywood who could hire me hated it. So they, I mean, it rendered me unhirable in a way because they thought, oh, he's the guy who's going to make movies with circus freaks and garbage and weirdos. And so we won't trust him to make a movie. But as time has gone on, it has found an audience. In fact, when it just came on Amazon Prime, I read some of the user reviews and it's got a lot of great reviews. I was so touched, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it's truly unique, original, weirdo movies do stand the test of time because they weren't made by a committee. It's like you can feel that voice. But you worked straight away. So that, like, when you say you're kind of going to a director's jail, but then the chase is, like, in my mind, we were talking about off air, I always thought of that as kind of a big movie because it feels big. It feels like a big chase action movie.
Well, I'll tell you, perception is everything, as we all know in Hollywood. So the chase is actually a very small independent movie. That was obtained by Fox and given a release and made to look like a studio movie.
Right. And Charlie Sheen was super hot,
and
right?
Charlie Sheen was very hot at that time. And I knew him because he had been in my first movie, Never on Tuesday. And so we had formed a friendship. And so he agreed to be in the chase. But I mean, that movie was made very Roger Corman style. Huh. You know, and the movie that kind of inspired that movie the most was Vanishing Point.
Yeah. Right? Oh, gosh. I have posters of that all over
Such
my house.
Such a great movie.
It's my favorite movie.
So, because that way we could pay Charlie a lot of money for a very short amount of time because 99% of his role is in the seat of that car, you know? So we could shoot him out real fast, but he's still the star of the movie. And then the rest of the time, we just shot cars chasing and screeching around corners, and it looked like a big movie.
Yeah.
And it was a great time, but the perception was that it was a studio movie that didn't perform, as opposed to an indie movie that actually made a ton of money.
Oh,
because the profits the movie that the chase made, Fox that year, Fox had we were the number three movie in their top three highest profits. I kid you not, Mrs. Doubtfire True Lies and The Chase were the highest profit earners because the movie was made so little. That the percentage of profit was high, you know what I mean? And those other movies were obviously just ginormous hits.
Right.
But that was not the perception in town. The perception in town was it was a Charlie Sheen studio movie that underperformed. Mm. So.
See, I saw it on a theater in New Zealand. I mean, how cool is that?
God bless
but
you.
But isn't that cool that, like, my perception, that's the same screen that I'd see Mrs. Doubtfire. It's just as big a movie to me.
That's
like,
awesome.
I remember really liking it.
It's funny you should, you know, this is something that we talked about a minute ago, which is that when I was a kid growing up, I had no perception of whether a movie was successful or not.
Right.
Yeah. I only liked it or I didn't like it. Right. And if I liked it, I wanted to see it again and I wanted to get it on video and watch it over and over. And if I didn't like it, I just never thought about it. Mm-hmm. I never thought of movies being successful or not successful.
That's why we all grew up when we found out, whenever you, wherever you were when you heard that the thing was a bomb, you're all like, what?
What?
Like, you just can't believe it because you weren't there.
Could not compute. Yeah, yeah, no, that movie was great. Yeah,
so how did you get the Chili Peppers in the chase?
The Chili Peppers agreed to be in the chase because we hired Henry Rollins to play a cop.
I forgot about both of this.
It was like a huge deal because I remember watching it and being like, that's Flea. Like, I just discovered Chili Peppers.
Wait, that done Point Break right around then, right?
Yeah.
So speaking of not having any studio interference on The Dark Backward, right, I then learned on The Chase, oh, this is what studio interference is, right? So we wanted to hire Henry Rollins to play a cop. We just thought that was so funny. And
he hadn't acted yet, right?
He had not acted.
He was doing his spoken word stuff That's at this time. Right. He was doing this like spoken word, I think it was called Out of the Box or something like that, where he talked about killing bunny rabbits at a pet shop or something like that. I remember it
He
vaguely,
said all kinds of extreme
from
things.
From the 90s.
And he looked like, you know, he had the flat top and the tattoos and the big neck and the muscles. And he looked to me like such a great cop caricature if you put him in the cop uniform, right? So we wanted him, and the studio said, no way. You can't have him play the cop. And so we created we did a screen test, but we did – and I hope this exists somewhere. And if The Chase ever is available on Blu-ray, I hope we can include it in the special features. We did a fake episode of Cops as a screen test.
Oh, my God.
With Rollins. Henry Rollins as a cop. I mean, we went all out. We shot a whole funny episode. And he was so funny in it that they agreed, okay, you can use him for the cop movie. But they thought, okay, they won that round. We're winning the next round. So then for another role, we got Charlton Heston to agree to play the part. Uh-huh. And we called the powers that be and we said, great news, we got Charlton Heston. They said, no, absolutely not. He's too old. You can't use Charlton Heston at all. We're putting our foot down. And we weren't allowed to use Charlton Heston. And so we used another actor who was fabulous. I mean, I love Ray Wise, brilliant actor, great guy. But we were forced to not use Charlton Heston. Now, of course, James Cameron immediately cast him in True Lies, and he was not too old, and he did a great job. And then he hosted Saturday Night Live, and he was awesome. You know what I mean? But that was a hard lesson for me that, this is what interference is like from the powers that be.
Let me tell you, if Henry Rollins ever got a copy of that Cops that you did, then he still has it. I can guarantee you that. Because
that dude has
held on to every single piece of anything he's ever been involved with. And it's in that house of his.
That is true.
It exists.
I'm going to have to reach out to him because that would be a great thing to see again and get out there.
But were you nervous about, because I mean, again, he was a musician, you know, Black Flag, Rollins Band, all that stuff, and he'd never acted before. But was it once you did the Cops episode that you knew he could do it?
I actually had a feeling, just having met him, that he was going to be great in the role of a cop. But when we shot the screen test, he was so great that I had absolutely no fear that he could pull it off. And then I think the studio felt, great. He looks great.
That launched his acting career.
Absolutely. And he's super funny. And a lot of the lines, he improvised. I mean, he said some really funny stuff.
Now, I want to talk about getting into what I assume is the studio system, because – I don't know if our listeners know, but you wrote things like Small Soldiers and
Mouse Hunt.
And so how does that happen?
Funny you should ask that.
I assume that's called I Like Eating.
Well, I like to pay rent.
I will tell you this, okay? I love all kinds of movies, all right?
Sure.
I love big movies, small movies, popcorn movies, indie movies, weird movies, you know, straight down the middle, you know.
You're like Joe Dante in that way. And that makes sense.
Absolutely. I love all kinds of movies. So I never felt being involved in those movies was selling out or mercenary work because I love doing them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they also afforded me the freedom to be able to make movies that were smaller and more personal. So to me, it was a win-win. But the way that I got into that world was I had been fired off a big movie, which was at that time the biggest movie I was ever a part of. That was a movie called Barb Wire.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah. That's a hot movie. Yeah.
Tim Awera Morrison.
Were you the writer?
I was the original director
of
Barb Wire.
What?
That's right.
Who ended up directing it? I don't even know.
I forget his name. I must have blocked it out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, tell us what happened.
So basically the nutshell story is I was hired by Dark Horse Comics, who owned the character. And I was basically hired without really all the approvals and the permission of the company that was funding the movie, PolyGram Propaganda. And they had a stable of directors that they wanted David Hogan. Mm-hmm. They wanted one of their directors to direct the movie. Anyway, it was a big push-pull between Dark Horse and PolyGram Propaganda. So I got hired and I got fired. Mm. And in getting fired, Propaganda PolyGram won and they put on one of their directors. All the people that called me to congratulate me that I got this big movie then were not returning my calls when it was on the front page of Variety that we went our separate ways due to creative differences, they say in the biz, right? Mm. So I wallowed in self-misery for about a day. And then I thought to myself, the only power I have right now in Hollywood is the ability to generate material from scratch because I'm a writer, right? I thought to myself, all right, if I look across the landscape, what does everybody want? Good material. They'll buy scripts, they'll option articles, books. I mean, every studio executive, every producer, every production company, they're all looking for material and they're all willing to spend money, chase it, beg for it, whatever. I can create it from scratch. And if I can create something that they want, I can turn this around. So I went on a writing tear and I started just banging out scripts while the movie was shooting. While Barbed Wire was still shooting, I wrote 4 screenplays. And the first 3 did not sell. But the fourth one was Mouse Hunt. And it changed everything for me. So my agent at the time, Alan Gasmer, was the kid. It's just interesting how timing is everything, too. You know, so Alan Gasmer was on a hot streak selling spec scripts. The spec script market also was hot at that time. He's tried to sell 3 other scripts of mine, and they didn't sell.
What were the other 3? Any unused gold in there?
Absolutely. Definitely. I intend to one day make them all, if
all
I can.
Right, all right.
But one of them, the first one of the group was a Titanic. It was a Titanic movie. Had a big part of it had to do with the Titanic. And as soon as I finished the movie, James Cameron announced his new movie was Titanic.
Every turn, James Cameron's fucking you up, man. Took Charlton Heston.
He's reading your mail.
Yeah. By the way, James Cameron did see The Chase at the time, and he said some very complimentary things about it. Wow. So I'm all good with James Cameron. All right. So Alan said, all right. Alan was losing interest in trying to sell these scripts of mine because 3 had not sold. But I wrote this comedy, Mouse Hunt, for those who haven't seen it, estranged brothers inherit a big, dilapidated old house. They discover the house has value. Because it's a historical house. So they're going to renovate it and split the money after they sell it and go their separate ways. And as they're trying to renovate it, they don't know that there's a mouse already living in the house who has no intention of giving up the house to these brothers. And he makes their lives miserable. And he's much smarter than they are. And he's messing with them.
And
right?
He's really adorable. And he's, so like you're cheering for the mouse
always,
the whole time.
Right. So Alan sent out the script. And the way that the spec market worked at that time was on a Tuesday, you send the script out to producers who have deals at individual studios. They hopefully read it, hopefully like it, hopefully agree to take the script to the studio they have a deal with. And then the studio will read the script on Wednesday. And by Thursday, you'll know if it's sold or if it's over. Right? It happened very fast. Mm. And Tuesday came and went and some producers were interested and they sent it to some studios. And then we got a bunch of passes, and I thought, oh, it's going to be over. But then, little by little, things started turning around, and a couple of studios wanted the script for amounts that I was beyond thrilled, like $100,000, mm-hmm. you know, for the script. I was like over the moon. And I said, sell it now. He's like, no, let's play this out. So it went to Thursday, and I think it even went to Friday, and I thought, he's going to blow it. Everything. He's ruining it. You know, and it was going up. Like one studio that was interested, like $105,000, $110,000. It's like, oh my God, this is incredible. And then for whatever reason, the timing was just right. They get a call from DreamWorks, which was a new studio at the time. Steven Spielberg wants to wrap this up right now. He wants Mouse Hunt. What would it take to wrap it up? And Alan said, there's several offers on the table, and we're about to close one, so I'd be bold. And they offered $1 million to buy the script.
Holy shit.
Which was on, I mean, because I had weeks ago had just been fired off this movie, and it was the worst day of my
life.
You
made Psycho Cop 2.
Right.
How the fuck did this happen?
Exactly. So anyway, my editor at the time is a guy named Peter Schenck. He no longer is an editor, but he had still been editing Barb Wire. I had hired him on as my editor for Barb Wire. So he was in, they had just done a test screening of Barb Wire. Right. This is my personal little
victory.
My personal little victory, yeah. Right? I wish nobody ill will in life, yeah, just in general, but this is my personal little smirk to the camera. So he was in the room when the producer of Barb Wire had the cover of Variety in one hand, which said, I sold the script to Steven Spielberg and DreamWorks for $1 million. And in the other hand, he had the test scores for Barb Wire, which were the lowest test scores in the test score company's history. Oh, and he was just looking back and forth at both. And that's my little, that's the happy ending of the movie about that moment in my
right.
life.
Yeah. That's unbelievable. What did that do for you right in the moment, besides financially? What did it do career-wise to have
it
that exposure?
It completely changed everything. Suddenly, I was on a different list that I had only heard rumored, that existed. So now I was approved as a studio writer on big family-friendly movies. And the next one I got at DreamWorks, which was Small Soldiers, which Steven Spielberg gave to me. Because he basically, I had a bunch of meetings with Steven Spielberg at that time, which was very exciting. I mean, Jaws was my favorite movie as a kid. I mean, after Mouse Hunt, he said, I'm green lighting Mouse Hunt. He said that in the first meeting. He said, I'm green lighting Mouse Hunt. He said, the only time I've greenlit a movie this fast after buying it was Gremlins, which I thought was, awfully cool. And then he said, and then another meeting, a couple weeks later, he said, I have this script we've been struggling with. I'm not going to have you read it, but I had a new way to approach it, and I want to see if it's something that's interesting to you. And he pitched me Small Soldiers, and he said, would you be interested in writing it? As if I'd say no, And I said, let me think about it. Yes, I will do that. So that 1-2 punch suddenly gave me an opportunity to write a whole bunch of movies at studios of a particular type of movie. Nobody was giving me, Sophie's Choice to write at studios, but they were giving me family-friendly movies.
Did you write a bunch that didn't get made for that season?
I wrote tons that didn't get made. I wrote a Where's Waldo movie for Paramount. I wrote a He-Man and the Masters of the Universe movie for Fox. I wrote a sequel to Jumanji that never got made. I wrote a Planet of the Apes movie that didn't get made. I wrote a whole bunch of them. In those days, too, development hell was just sort of the norm. So many, 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 many more movies were developed than were ever made. And it was a great, great gig. And so those opportunities afforded me the freedom to make small movies. And I just funded some of my own movies with the money I made writing these other movies, because I got to greenlight my own movies and have total freedom again. It was great.
How did you leave that world? At what point was it to pursue directing your own movies? How did that world change for you?
I didn't decide to leave it, and I haven't left it. In fact, I'm having a meeting next week about a big animated family movie, and I had one last week about a different big family movie. So I'm still in that world.
Yeah.
But I just got so busy writing and directing these smaller, more passion projects that took up a lot of my time. And then after the Writers Guild strike, things changed in the industry, and way fewer films were being developed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And those price tags were not being paid anymore. So those were the halcyon days of development hell. It was development heaven too, So
how was Joe? Did you get to do any of the development with Joe, or was Joe brought on when the script was finished for Small Soldiers?
Joe was brought on after I was finished writing it. And other writers had come on after that who were on set, and they did work with Joe on set. But I had already known Joe before, because I had written two other scripts that Joe almost directed, and they they didn't ultimately happen.
What were those ones?
One was called Really Big Bugs, which was a giant insect movie.
I'm in.
On point for Joe, don't
you? Totally on point for Joe. And one was called All Shook Up, which was about these two Elvis impersonators that were on the run together after witnessing a murder.
Huh.
What was your initial meeting like with Joe, having known him, you know, on Small Soldiers? What was the creative like?
You know, I really wasn't involved in that meeting. I mean, I knew him, and he had been hired, and I was just excited that he was on, because in a way, Small Soldiers is a lot like Gremlins.
Yeah,
you know, and so. He was the perfect choice, and I was just so happy to see him.
Yeah.
You know, I knew it was going to be in great hands, and I knew the humor would be intact because he's such so funny with that stuff.
Yeah. What do you think of the final outcome of the movie?
I think the movie's great. Yeah. I really like the way it turned out. It's very close to the way we all imagined it when we were writing it, and I know Joe totally got what we were doing, and mm-hmm. he did a great job. So
that's cool.
You know, one thing that's really sad though is obviously the death right just days before the movie opened of Phil Hartman, which was terrible.
Sure. I hadn't thought about the timing of that.
I mean, just literally a few days before it opened, he was killed.
I know Detroit Rock City was a passion project, right?
Absolutely.
Was that one that wasn't obviously self-funded, because that feels like quite a big movie?
That was a bigger movie. What happened, interestingly enough, speaking of The Chase, mm-hmm. and how these things sort of come full circle, when I was making The Chase, the assistant editor was a guy named Carl Dupre, who wrote he wrote Detroit Rock City on spec.
Yeah.
And he asked me if I would read it. And I read it, and I thought it was great. And he said, if I ever get this made, would you consider directing it? I said, I'd love to, but I thought to myself, this will never get made.
Yeah.
Kiss isn't together. The cost of those songs would be impossible to afford. Gene Simmons would never agree. You know, whatever. Yeah. I just thought, good luck. Anyway, I went about my life. And little did I know that Carl partnered up with a producer named Barry Levine, who had been Kiss's photographer in their 70s and 80s years. And then he was becoming a movie producer. And then he partnered with Gene Simmons as a producer on the movie. And Kiss reunited for the reunion tour. And it all became a very attractive package. And another interesting thing, a girl I happened to be dating at the time was also a producer. And she came on board not even knowing I had ever read the script. And she said, I've partnered up on this project called Detroit Rock City, and we were thinking you should give it a read and see if it's something you'd be interested in directing. And I thought, not only have I already read it, but I've already agreed to direct it.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, so that was great.
I assume you grew up a big Kiss fan. And
I was a big Kiss fan, but more than Kiss because of the Kiss Army stuff, I just was a huge... First of all, I was a big Monster fan, and so to me, Gene Simmons was a monster, and I knew that Gene Simmons was a fan of monsters. But I was not a Kiss fanatic like I was a movie fanatic. Mm-hmm. I was a Kiss fan, and I also was a 70s pop culture fan, and to me, they're such a big part of 70s pop culture. So I was a fan of all of that. I sold myself to Gene like I was the biggest Kiss fan, but later on, I told him I wasn't always the biggest Kiss fan, and he thought that was very funny. He appreciated that. To get a chance to recreate the 70s and the that era was really what I was mainly excited about doing.
Yeah.
You know, what of the last couple of years of your personal projects is the one, I don't want to say that you're most proud of, but one that you hope more people discover? Like, because obviously the smaller projects are the things that are a little bit more closer to you personally.
Sure.
So is there one in particular as of late that you'd want our audience to check out?
Well, the one that I'm the most excited about currently is my newest film. Mm-hmm. It is called Dog Years, but the title will change. Mm-hmm. The distributor is... company called A24.
Oh,
and
awesome.
They bought it. It premiered at Tribeca this year.
Burt Reynolds, man.
So it stars. It's wow. It's a drama.
Oh, I've seen a scene from this, believe it
or
not.
Oh, you have?
Because a certain writer of A History of Violence, he said it's one of the best things he's seen in a long time, Josh.
That's so cool.
And he showed us just the start, and he said he blew his mind at Burt Reynolds at the opening, and it was an amazing moment. I'd forgotten what the movie was till now. So
thank you.
I haven't seen the whole thing, though.
So it's a drama. It's about an old man who used to be the biggest movie star in the world and now finds himself on hard times, and the events of the movie force him to face the mistakes of his past, right? And I wrote it specifically for Burt Reynolds.
Wow.
Because when I was a kid, Burt Reynolds was my hero, right?
Coolest
the coolest guy on the planet, biggest movie star in the world, but also the most approachable, funniest, talk show stories like you never could possibly believe. I mean, just the greatest guy. And so when I got older and I started making movies of my own, I thought to myself, you know, I always felt Burt never got his due as an actor because of the choice of movies he made.
Yeah.
You know, they were fun, but sort of fluff movies. And his contemporaries were getting all the Oscars. And I thought, you know, but he's a great actor. And he never looks like he's acting, no matter what movie he does. And also, he's great in Deliverance. He's genuinely great.
That's one of my favorite roles.
He's genuinely great in The Longest Yard.
White Lightning.
Yeah, it's great in those. So I thought, I'm just worried that people are going to only remember how great he is after it's too late. So I thought, I'm going to roll the dice. I'm going to write a movie for Burt Reynolds that I think could be like a great final role. Uh-huh. And I'm going to send it to him. And some friends said, well, why don't you call him and see if he's even open to doing something like that and before you spend the time writing it. I said, no, because the best version of me doing that is him saying, I'll read it when you finish it. Send it to me. So I thought, I'm just going to write it now, roll the dice, and try it. So I wrote it for him. I'd never met him. I submitted it to his manager. And I said, please tell Burt that if he doesn't want to make this movie, I'm not making it. I only wrote it for Burt. And the next day, I get a call from Burt Reynolds, which was a mind blower. I mean, I've met famous people before, but Burt Reynolds is in a different league to me.
Yeah. Right?
When I think of movie star, I will forever think of Burt Reynolds.
I mean, him and Clint Eastwood are the last two big ones I can think
of
from a different generation.
Absolutely. So he called me up and he said, listen, this script hits very close to home and it deals with things that are hard for me to deal with. And I thought, okay, he's going to say no, thank you. But then he said, and if you had sent it to me 10 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to face it. But he said, now where I am in my life, I have to do it. And he said, I'm in. And my mind was blown.
Yeah,
and
man.
So he's so good in the movie.
That's what I've heard. It didn't it play at Tribeca?
It premiered at Tribeca.
Yeah, because I was there and I wish I had seen it because I was there for 2 days and I didn't get to see
it. Oh, too bad.
Yeah.
Well, it premiered at Tribeca, and out of Tribeca, it got bought by A24, who were our first choice for distributor.
Yeah, they're the best company right now.
I mean, they know how to release indie movies so like nobody's business. And so they have a really great idea for a new title, which we love, which I'm not allowed to say because they're going to do it as an announcement. And they're going to release it next year, and they're going to give Burt an Oscar push, which I believe his performance is worthy of it. It's that good. And I'm just so thrilled that it's been getting positive attention because it's a real – my love for Burt is what started this, and the fact that Burt's getting love because of his performance makes me feel really good.
That's really phenomenal. A beautiful story. Can't think of somebody going out on a limb writing, spending the time to write something with the chance. It's kind of like writing a love letter to the one person you love where you could get denied.
Totally.
It's very, I don't know, it feels like it's from a Jane Austen, but to Burt Reynolds.
Right.
Which I love. It's awesome.
But I'll tell you this. When I was a kid dreaming about what it would be like to be pals with Burt Reynolds, you know, and you know, they say you never meet your heroes because you'll always be disappointed. But he's exactly what I dreamed he would be like. He's just the coolest, greatest, sweetest, most fun, funny guy. He's everything I hoped he'd be when I was a kid.
Why didn't he, and he might have even talked about it, I've always wondered, because the only other great role he's had in the last like 20, 30 years was Boogie Nights.
Right.
Why did he not get that, do you think? Because he just obviously, I mean, he was amazing. To me, that's Oscar worthy too, but he clearly, you know, he fired his manager over, he hated the movie. What was that about, you think?
He had issues with the subject matter.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and so ultimately, he felt he knows the movie's good, and he appreciates the people appreciate him in the movie. But the experience and what the movie's about, you know, Burt is a Southern gentleman, frankly.
Okay, interesting.
And he felt the movie glorified the porn world, and ultimately, he was left uncomfortable with that.
Interesting.
You know,
wow.
But he deserves an Oscar, all the Oscars for Sharky's Machine.
Oh my God, yes.
That's my favorite of all his movies.
Fantastic.
I love Shark. And he directed it.
He directed Sharky's Machine. He directed The End, which is a great movie. I mean, he's a great filmmaker.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're running out of time and stuff, but you know, let's talk a little bit about the genre. Like, how often do you, since you love movies, how often do you keep up on movies? What are kind of the horror things you've seen in the last couple of years that really excite you and kind of renew your love of the genre?
Well, I love, I try to watch movies as often as I can. You know, I mean, I just love movies, and I'm an easy audience because I just love the experience of movies. You know, I mean, a lot of, I know a lot of people who are super critical, and, you know, I mean, I can recognize intellectually, you know, when something is working or isn't working, but if I'm engaged and I'm having fun with a movie, I like it, even if it's not a great movie, you know. That said, I love great movies, you know. So, I mean, some of the movies that I've seen lately that I liked, I mean, I liked, what's the Netflix movie with the demon who, and the book, and what's the name of it? I'm bad with names.
Adam Wingard's movie.
Death Note. Yeah, I like Death Note.
Yeah.
I like Death Note. I thought that was fun. I thought that demon was cool. You know what I mean?
Do you like kind of more serious, like movies like The Witch and stuff? Do you like that kind of horror, or do you prefer the fun?
I like it all. Okay. I'll tell you this. Movies with monsters and demons and stuff like that.
Sweet spot.
I love them, but they don't scare me. Uh-huh. I love them, but they don't scare me. The movies that are more real are the ones that scare me.
Yeah.
The ones that I actually think, like, for example, right? When I was arriving here tonight, and I was in the parking lot, and nobody was around, and I was knocking the door, and nobody could hear me.
Oh.
I felt like this was the beginning of a Jason Blum movie. I swear to God. I mean, it's like an industrial parking lot.
Yeah.
The gate closed behind me. I didn't know how I was going to get out. That kind of thing.
It was we set it up for you.
Very well done.
Then Adam scared the shit out of me because I opened the door and he was standing behind it where I couldn't see you, and he just popped out.
That's true.
And so we were both in a Jason Blum movie.
But things that are real scare me more.
Yeah.
Like I saw the original Paranormal Activity like 2 years before it came out, right? And I was turned on to it by Joe Lynch, who had seen it at Slam Dance, right? And so I reached out to Oren and asked him for a copy of it. And so I didn't know him, but I met him because of Joe Lynch. And I watched that alone at night at home, and that scared the crap out of me because I felt like that, you know, like just sounds in the middle of the night feel more real to me than giant monsters. But that said, I love giant monster movies, and I love gore, and I mean – mean-spirited movies aren't as fun to me.
Yeah.
You know, where I really feel that the filmmaker or the fans are fetishizing a sort of a pain and a loss and a torture that sort of loses fun, I don't really get into. I've seen a lot of them.
Yeah.
And I'll see more of them, and I'm fine that they exist, but they're just not as fun for me, you know. Yeah. I remember when I was a kid, I can't remember what the movie was. I remember I was in line when I was like 12 at midnight for some movie that was like a, you know, it was like a torture porn movie. It might have been Pieces. I mean, I heard you guys talking about Pieces earlier. It might have been Pieces. And some of the people in the audience, in the line waiting to get in, felt a little too much like they were too into the idea of people actually being killed. Like this was fulfilling a genuine fantasy of theirs. I didn't like that so much.
Yeah.
To me, I was so excited when I was growing up about Rubberheads and Tom Savini and Rick Baker, and look how real that looks.
Fantasy.
But I know how,
fantasy is what you're buying into.
Yes.
We always talk about that.
I love the fantasy of that kind of stuff, but I don't like real violence. I don't want to see a snuff film. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't
want
anybody to really be hurt. I don't like when real animals are hurt. You know, I just don't. I don't like any of that. I like the fantasy of it.
But you don't love realism like Chillerama? Like your segment in Chillerama was just so real.
There's no better creature than Wadzilla.
That's actually a true story. It happened to me.
That is a hell goopy movie. You're part of that.
Watching that, you just need some bleach and some tissues. Just clean yourself
and
up.
And a shower. A good shower.
A shower. Yeah. Wow. Jesus Christ.
Man, Adam, we can talk on and on, but let's save it for the next time you come on. Because we're going to be talking about some of the other movies, including the one that we're trying to get out into the
world. I would love it. That would be fantastic.
So thank you so much for coming out, man.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you all very much. And I will say, if I just may, on the way out, because we are in, you know, Jason Blum headquarters, a movie that came out recently that I loved was Get Out.
Of course.
Awesome. Oh, excellent.
I thought it was awesome. It was scary. It was cool and funny.
It's not a comedy, though, right? According to
Golden Globe, say it's a comedy. So it's officially a comedy. Yeah, but Golden Globe have a long track record of miscategorizing. It's something will be a comedy musical.
But the other thing, too, is it's not necessarily a drama.
Yeah.
So
and it has probably a better shot.
Maybe Golden Globe should just open up a genre category, possibly.
Or just put in documentary, like Jordan suggested.
That said, it does have a funny character at least. So that's good. You know,
I thought it was great.
It is a great movie.
Well, thank you so much, Adam.
Thank you.
Give our love to Bert. If you ever talk to Bert, say
tell him
people love
him.
Elric says hello.
Elric loves him.
Love to. Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
See you soon.